Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 17th, 18th of August. Irish Fest opens tomorrow evening on the lakeshore here in Milwaukee. It is now the world's largest Irish music festival. For those of you who have not attended, you simply must. They not only have musicians that are not to be beat, they have dogs. That's always where I go first. I go to the dogs and look at the Irish setters and Irish Wheaton Terriers. They have cultural experiences. This year we'll be showcasing Northern Ireland, which is an important area to be showcased. Tons and tons of musicians, and we are honored to have Mick Maloney with us this hour of the program. He's in town for Irish Fest and has been here for many Irish Fests because it is the 30th anniversary of this wonderful festival. Many of you know Mick Maloney. He has many talents. He is an ethnomusicologist, a musician, a singer. He has won the National Endowment for the Arts National Heritage Fellowship, and I believe he received that in 1999. He has done many, many albums. Early 20th century popular song has recorded them. He has also taken many people. He leads a series of Irish folklore tours that offer authentic Irish cultural odysseys that conventional tourists never experience. He is the author of Far From the Shamrock Shore, the story of Irish-American history through song, and we'll talk a great deal about Irish-American history during the course of this hour, plus we'll hear more of his music, plus we'll hear other musicians, plus we'll welcome your phone calls. We'll have a wonderful time this hour. We've done this traditionally for years and years and years and years, and I always look forward to this show. Our phone number for you to join the conversation is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And our email address is talk@wpr.org. Mick's latest CD is, I love this title, If It Wasn't for the Irish and the Jews. And we'll hear something from that during this hour. Hello, Mick. Thanks so much for being with us.
Lovely to be with you.
Ah, great to have you here. You know, it's interesting you brought this in because I was thinking the other day, most of my friends, and it's not true of all of my friends, I have many friends of many ethnic backgrounds, but many of them are either Irish or Jewish. And I was trying to think, why is that the case? And now here you have this CD.
I think it's a very good cultural fit. You know, we're both widely dispersed cultures with a diaspora. And when the big migrations happened to America in the Irish case after the famine and in the Jewish case in the late 19th century, especially from Russia, these people had nowhere to go back to. They were here to stay. And they were here to make an imprint and to do the best they could. And both cultures are great lovers of the arts and great lovers of education. The Irish were very prominent in music in the 19th century, and the Jews were, when they arrived, equally prominent. And it's just a very good cultural fit, both very hospitable cultures, you know. And, of course, they entered into competition in America once they came here. There was competition, but there was also cooperation. And I live in New York City right now. It's a very Jewish town. I just love it. I love the style of it, the directness of it, the fun of it, the liberal politics. That would be my own personal take, of course. And I find it very comfortable. Nearly all my major collaborations in America have been with Jewish people. I lived with a Jewish family when I came here first. And
did you really?
I didn't know any Jewish people in Ireland at all, but it just was a direct fit. One of the things I found almost disarming was that people said what they thought. To any Irish person at that time, I say, you mean they're telling you what they think? Really? There's no subtext? I like that. It was something different. And I think it's a good blend because sometimes to be maybe a little too direct mightn't be entirely appropriate at certain times. And certainly to be as indirect as we are most of the time might not work too well. But I think put the two together and you're in great shape.
Yeah. So tell me about your emigration story from Ireland to America.
Well, again, my Jewish professor, Kenneth Goldstein, asked me to apply for a fellowship to the University of Pennsylvania. They had a folklore department. There were only four folklore departments in America at the time. And I was very interested in old music and old songs and old stories and all of that. And I applied and I got turned down. But in the process of applying, it really cleared my mind. I was 27. I didn't know what I was going to do in life. I was playing music and enjoying it. But I knew that I couldn't make a living playing traditional music, old music, for the whole of my life. I knew I'd have to have some something else. So I had to think through what I really wanted to do in my life. And you know, when you're in your 20s, you don't give a lot of thought to that, you know. And I finally decided that what my life was going to be about. And I wrote back to Kenny Goldstein, and I said, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to think about my life and what I wanted to do. And I said, whatever I want to do is going to be in the arts and music, and it's going to be teaching. It's going to be some combination of that and helping out people in the arts and so on. And he was so impressed with my letter that he got me a scholarship. So the lesson here is that when you get rejected, I suppose, he'd be very nice about it and maybe something good will happen. At least that's the way it worked out for me. And I ended up in Philadelphia and I've been here in America ever since. That was 1973.
Oh my. Well, it's good to have you here.
Well, it's lovely to be here, and I love Milwaukee. And on a day like this, I feel like I'm on the Mediterranean, you know, looking out at the lake and the beautiful colours, and what a lovely town it is anyway. But on a day like this, it's literally resplendent.
Isn't this festival fantastic?
It's the best.
It is
absolutely the best, and it's now world famous. And you can talk to people in Australia about Irish festivals, and they'll ask you, "Have you ever been to the big Irish festival in Milwaukee?" And they wouldn't have known where Milwaukee was, you know, in America on the map, most of them. But the festival and its success, and it's now 30 years, of course, has put Milwaukee on the map in the big Irish diaspora across the worldwide. And even when the president of Ireland decided to come to America some years back, she had to choose between, I suppose, the mind and the heart. And in other words, she would maybe have the choice of going to Washington and talking to politicians. But she chose instead to go to the heart of it all, and she came to Milwaukee.
I had a chance to meet her that day.
Wasn't that a great thing that an Irish president would pick Milwaukee out of all the places in America to come to and be associated with Irish America?
Yeah, I agree.
What a great thing.
Yeah. I know you know a great deal and have written about the waves of immigration. I guess I was not aware until I was reading about you that the first wave came in 1600. To America, very early.
You wouldn't call it a wave necessarily. There were people, a lot of people who were indentured, people who just are, in every society there are adventurers, people who leave, people who move, people who are restless. And I would say the first Irish people, in the sense, certainly goes back to that time, would have come perhaps as indentured servants. They would have sold their labour for 4 or 5 years. They would have looked for a new life. The certain personality type that does that. But the first big waves, you would say, if you say, would be the Scotch Irish, the people that were called the Scotch Irish here, people from the north of Ireland. A lot of them were Presbyterians, and some indeed were Catholics. But they came from the north of Ireland because things were tough there, and they saw opportunities in America that just didn't exist in Europe at that time, opportunities particularly to buy land and to create a new life. So all through the 1700s, waves of settlers came from the northern counties of Ireland, and they would have come up the Delaware River, a lot of them, and settled in Philadelphia. Some ended up being very prosperous, like the Mellons of Pennsylvania, you know, and the Mellon Bank is named after them, of course, and Andrew Jackson, you know, who... The famous Andrew Jackson was these people from the north of Ireland. But the vast majority were poor. And they would have eventually gone across, as the 17th century went, or the 18th century went on, they would have gone across the state of Pennsylvania and gone down the Great Wagon Road into the Appalachians and met there with English and Scottish and settlers and the Cherokee Indians, and there would be German settlers, and then, of course, African Americans. And old-time music and eventually bluegrass came out of that mixture of the melodies of the Gaelic tradition, shall we say, and the backbeat and rhythm of the African traditions, and the music that we now enjoy as bluegrass or old-time Appalachian music came out of that mixture. I'd love to have been a time traveller. If I was a time traveller, I'd love to go back there and see what that was all like.
Maybe one day you can do that. That's the latest technology. It's down the road. We don't know yet. Yeah. And tell me more about this, because this musical tradition of telling the life in song and story has been so much a part of Irish culture for a long, long time.
It has, and it's not just because perhaps under colonialism it was the only way to express ourselves. That was part of it. But the tradition of the storyteller, of the person who would be reciting oral history and remembering it, that goes way back to the Celtic origins of our people. And there were many people involved in the Celtic courts, as it were, the Celtic kingdoms. There was the poet was the Shanachie, there was the bard was the musician, the druid was kind of the diviner and the high priest, and also the jurist. There were many different figures, all cultural figures in Celtic life, and their job partly was to the historian's job was to remember things. So the orality of the culture goes way back to our Celtic times, and passing on things orally rather than literally. That's very deeply rooted in our society. And my late great mentor and friend Frank Hart, his mantra was that those in power write the history, while those who suffer write the songs.
Oh.
And we certainly, under colonialism, had our share of hard times. And we expressed a lot of our feelings in song, because nobody can stop you doing that.
Mm-hmm. I know a number of the musicians who are coming here, because I've been to the festival all 30 years, bring their sons and daughters who are carrying on the tradition. Did you come from a family where that written tradition and oral and musical tradition were very, very prominent, and you just carried on with that?
Not really. No. Certainly oral. Everyone likes to talk in Ireland.
I know. That's why I love it.
You can't shut us up. But in terms of the music, my mother and father wouldn't have been called musicians. They might have played a little bit on the piano. But going back, my mother's people were from a part of Ireland that's very famous for its music, and my father's people were very famous for its music. And I would like to think that somewhere genetically there was a genetic imprint in the family tree. It would be hard for that not to happen, frankly. And I think we know very little about genetics, and I know that when I heard this music for the first time, I just wanted to play it, and there was not a logical decision. I just heard it, and I said, I heard a banjo player playing in the rain in O'Connell Street in Limerick with the fiddle player.
Aww.
and they were huddled so that the rain wouldn't hit the bow of the fiddle, and there were travelling people collecting their money. And as soon as I heard it, I said, I want to do this.
Aww.
And there's no logic to that.
Yeah, and the fiddle came from Italy.
It would have, yeah. And the fiddle has been around in Irish music for 400 years or so, but the banjo has only been around for 150, and the banjo would have come from Africa and been appropriated in America and used in minstrelsy by white people. And then the minstrels carried the banjo to Ireland in the middle 19th century, and it's been around there ever since. And that's my instrument. My main instrument is the banjo.
Mm-hmm. It's a great instrument, isn't it?
I tell you, it's very lively. It's very hard to be depressed when you're playing the banjo.
Right.
You know? You might depress other people, but...
You can't be depressed when you're playing the banjo. There's your next book. It's not a bad title.
Yeah.
This gift of gab is something that is so wonderful about Ireland. And if you travel to the country, you just don't meet any strangers. Everybody is in... It's one of the most hospitable places on earth, I think. And I'm not sure where that comes from, but what a welcoming place. You can sit down and talk to anybody about anything.
Well, you can, and that tradition of hospitality, of course, we took it for granted growing up, you know, but that you would share your last bite of food with the stranger or give it to the stranger, that was absolutely taken for granted in Ireland. I was very interested to find out, not too many years ago when I started to study early monasteries in Ireland, it was the same thing, the tradition of absolute unconditional hospitality in every monastery, and most of the towns in Ireland would have started out their life as a monastery. In every monastery, there was a place where any person passing by would be unconditionally accepted and allowed to stay for as long as they wanted before they moved on in journey. And of course, hospitality, hospice, hospital, it all denotes the whole notion of welcoming somebody who's going through a hard time, mm-hmm. physically or mentally. And that was taken for granted when I was growing up in Ireland, that you would be hospitable to people. And I'm delighted, in a sense, to be part of a culture that feels like that. And
you must be.
To this day. Well, even more so because of the arts, you know, and to be known around the world for music and singing and dancing and storytelling and Nobel Prize winners in literature. It's a fine thing. There are a lot of other things you could be known for. On the whole, this is just fine with me.
There's also, though, a theme of sadness. And when I think of Irish music, there's this joyous, wonderful music. There's also, I don't know how many, and maybe you have a handle on this, how many farewell songs there are. There are a lot of goodbye. I'm leaving my love. I'm leaving my country. I'm going off to, you know, Australia or America or wherever, and I hope to be back to see you again. And they're sad. They tug at your heart.
They're very sad, and, you know, there are thousands and thousands of them. There's no way you could put a number on how many there are. Part of it is because the immigration was really one way. You know, immigration, there was no word in the Irish language for immigrant in the 19th century. The only word was Joree, and Joree translates as exile.
Oh, my.
So when you use that word, there are two things, there are two connotations to that. One is that you're leaving involuntarily. You know, it's thrust upon you by circumstances. And number one, you're not coming back. And that, I know that when a few of us were involved in doing the research for the first documentary on Irish immigration, it was called Out of Ireland. It was a film made by Paul Wagner, who won an Oscar for The Stone Carvers. He put together a crew to do research for this movie on Irish immigration out of Ireland. We found a shocking statistic that whereas in the 19th century, say 50% of Italian immigrants and maybe 70% of Greek immigrants, 60% of Polish immigrants went back to their home country after spending some years here, fewer than 5% of the Irish returned. And yet we sang about going back. More than all the rest of them put together. It was a one-way trip because in the famine, people lost their lands. They didn't own their lands anyway. There was nowhere to go back to, literally. There was no homeland. And in that sense, I think the Jewish diaspora was quite similar to the Irish in the sense that you were coming on a one-way trip. Mm-hmm. And what was it to go back to? Except, you know, with some exceptions, there were people maybe who came from better circumstances. So all those songs of leaving, the sad songs of leaving, I think, are related to that. But funnily enough, most of those songs were written in Ireland. They weren't written in America, even though we have a huge tradition here in America of songs of leaving Ireland, of singing them. But they were mostly written in Ireland because most immigrants are in their 20s. And when I came, I wasn't nostalgic at all. I wasn't in the slightest bit missing anything because in my head was, well, of course I'm going to go back, you know. You don't know what's going to happen when you're in your 20s and you're looking forward. You're not looking over your shoulder. Right. So I would think the songs are, and certainly the evidence would indicate, songs are written to the people who were left behind. And if you watched your 14-year-old son or daughter go off to America and you knew in your heart that you were never going to see them again, you could totally identify with that song of leaving. And Frank Hart, who was my great singer and mentor, he appeared here at the festival several times and he passed away a couple of years ago. Frank's father, he never saw his elder brothers or sisters ever in his lifetime. He never saw them. They were all gone by the time he was born and they never came back and he never went. And so that sense of the melancholic sense, the sad sense, it comes from that reality. Mm-hmm. And it's the story of our people, part of it. That's why the songs really, uncannily, they represent kind of portals into a certain social reality, which has to be amplified by research if you want to be a historian. But they give you a clue as to what's important.
Are you nostalgic now?
Of course you are. You're nostalgic. I'm nostalgic for all the people, you know, when you lose your parents, when you lose family members and when you go back and you remember the way things were. Of course you're going to be nostalgic. But that's just a story of everybody. You've just got to get on with your own life. You know, the nostalgia is always mediated by the friendships that you have, and especially when you're a member of a community like the Irish musicians or the arts community or the people who run the festival here. They're your new family, and that's the new reality. And I think the whole challenge is to try to be in that moment as much as you can. But I think you always have to be respectful towards and mindful of what's been left behind. And the songs help to do that in a very safe way. They create a safe space for you to identify with the things that were without getting too maudlin.
All right, well, welcome phone calls. And here's our number, 800-486-8655. Mick Maloney is our guest this hour. He has done so much to teach us about Irish history. He's a marvelous musician. He's done a series of films, PBS specials, and he teaches as well. We're welcoming phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. 8655. We also have a pair of tickets. If you go to our Facebook page, we're going to do this randomly. Two tickets to Irish Fest. So we're going to just do a drawing. We're going to collect all your names, and then we're going to pick one of those names, and we'll let you know, and you'll be able to go to Irish Fest, which starts tomorrow at 5 o'clock on the Henry Meyer Festival grounds in beautiful, on Lake Michigan, Milwaukee.
Just returned from Europe, I've seen London and Paris, and I'm glad to get back home to Yankee land. In fact, the little USA looks better now to me. It's the real place for the real folks, understand. But still I often sit and think, what would this country do if it hadn't men like Rosenstein and Hughes? We'd surely have a kingdom, there'd be no democracy if it wasn't for the Irish and the Jews. What would this great Yankee nation
really be? Oh, I like it. I like it. Mick Maloney, and this is from his new CD, If It Wasn't for the Irish and the Jews. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. And I'm corrected. We have two pairs of tickets for Irish Fest. So go to our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and write a little something. And then we'll take a drawing after this show and let you know. We go to phone calls now for Mick Maloney. Gary is from Madison, and he joins us. Hi, Gary.
It's Jerry, Kathleen.
Oh, it's Jerry. Hi, Jerry.
Yes, I just wanted to make a brief comment. Those Scotch-Irish that came to this country in the 8th centuries, a great many of them settled in the Appalachians and the Blue Ridge and the Smoky Mountains. And they named their first born son, William, after their folk hero, William of Orange. And as a result, they came to be known collectively as the Hillbillies. And I also wanted to add that their music, which also was called bluegrass, reflected their Celtic roots.
Mick.
Well, of course, that's true. The music that we call hillbilly music, or old-time or Appalachian music, very heavily influenced by these migrations from the north of Ireland. And most of the people who came were indeed Protestants. The vast majority would have been poor Presbyterians. There were others as well, Methodists and Anglicans. And there were Catholics too. You see, if you were a Catholic at that time and you came over, there was no Catholic church. So if you wanted to continue to worship, you would join a Protestant, a fundamentalist sect, probably like a Baptist sect or maybe a private church. And even though later on fundamentalist Protestant religion became associated with a reluctance to involve oneself in any kind of art, for when things of the Methodist revival in Wales in the late, all the instruments were burned. At that time, there's every indication that people did play the fiddle and did sing. And there in the mountains, a mysterious mixture of influences from England and Scotland and the north of Ireland and Africa created this music that eventually ended up as bluegrass. But the roots of it were back then. So that's absolutely true.
And what he says about hillbillies is true.
There are many theories of origin of that, and that's certainly one very plausible one.
Mm-hmm. I've noticed, and I think this is wonderful, that Northern Ireland is to be showcased at this year's Irish Fest. It's one of those, I had the pleasure, really, of, it's so beautiful, driving along the whole northern coast 2 years ago for a family vacation. And I was so struck. know about what's been going on, but I was struck by the divisions in societies as we looked. You know, you, obviously, just by the signs that were greeting you as you went into town, it was either a Protestant town or a Catholic town or Protestant, all the way across. So it's there's still a great deal of division, and we've seen there have been some problems this summer. It's good to highlight Northern Ireland, and I wonder your assessment of progress that has been made, if the divisions are not as severe as they used to be, Mick?
Well, it's hard to say if the divisions are as severe. I mean, the divisions exist in people's heads, but certainly in terms of the level of violence and certainly in terms of the level of opportunities, the greater opportunities for the minority Catholics, we've made extraordinary progress. And the peace processes, which was really generated and assisted immeasurably by the Clinton administration here, George Mitchell played a major role in that. So I think Ireland has an awful lot to thank America for in terms of people putting down their guns, putting down their arms. And we have a peace process, and it's inevitable that it should be fairly shaky for the first couple of decades. But it's holding. Yes, there's been tremendous progress. And I would say, you know, the next couple of generations are going to reap the full benefits from that. And I'm delighted to say, too, that the arts, people like Tommy Sands, who's here at the festival, has been a major figure. The artists have always been at the cutting edge. Artists will work together no matter what, because that's the way we are. We don't care where people are from, generally speaking, as long as we share the passion for art and creating art. And Irish Fest has always brought people from the north of Ireland, from the very, very start. It never acknowledged that there were divisions, or if it saw those divisions, they were irrelevant. It brought people from both sides, from the north of Ireland. That's, Irish Fest has really been at the cutting edge of inclusiveness, shall we say, from the very, very start. We're very, very beholden to Irish Fest in Milwaukee. It set a very high bar for the rest of the Irish arts world, especially music and dance. But now, really branching out beyond those forms, Irish Fest is just totally remarkable. And the north of Ireland has been one of their briefs from the very start.
I'm so happy to hear that. Mm-hmm. That's good. Let's go to John from Madison. Hi, John.
Hey, guys, your irrepressibly enthusiastic and wonderful guest reminded me of a great experience I had bumping into a couple of young Irish gals in the Italian Riviera, three buddies. I just got dumped by my girlfriend, my fault. My buddy just got divorced by his wife, his fault. Oh. Another buddy was a serial, you know, never had a girlfriend, and that's definitely his fault. Three depressed single guys go to a European little, you know, jaunt around. Bump into these two delightful Irish gals in Cinque Terre, this is the northern Italian Riviera. One of my buddies is Irish, and between the three, they just lifted all of our spirits and had such a wonderful time. None of us guys got lucky, but that's more of a testament of the fine morals of those young women as opposed to our powers of persuasion. But I truly admire the Irish spirit, and what a wonderful guest.
Well, thank you very much. I must say that, you know, there may be more complex reasons involved, but the math seems quite off there with three fellows and two Irish girls. Maybe you could revisit that situation and just add or subtract somebody, and things might have worked out different. But lovely to hear from you. I'm glad that the Irish were of assistance in that instance.
In case you're still looking, come to Irish Fest, and you may get some free tickets if you go to Facebook. Let's go to Bridget from Barrington, Illinois. Hi, Bridget.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi. I'm so excited to talk to Mick. When I was a graduate student in Philadelphia in the late 70s, and I used to go see him play all the time at the University of Pennsylvania when he was playing with Eugene O'Donnell, and they were always wonderful shows. And I have a question. My all of my great-grandparents came from Ireland around the turn of the last century, and I was lucky enough to still know one who lived a long life, and from what he told me and my other relatives, that they had no nostalgia for Ireland. It's only the succeeding generations that seem to, you know, delve back into the music. And along those same lines, I really like the recordings you've done about the Tin Pan Alley Irish American songs. But I'm wondering, who were those aimed at? Were the Irish listening to those, or going to those shows?
This is a very interesting question. And, you know, I didn't really know the answer or a possible answer to that myself until 1995, which was the 150th anniversary of the beginning of the Great Irish Famine. And I was part of a kind of a deputation of artists and scholars who went around America giving talks and, in my case, singing songs about and talking about the impact of the Great Famine on America. And I went to places that I wouldn't have been, you know, familiar with before, places like Des Moines, Iowa, and Moline, Illinois, and lots of other places, Spokane, Washington, and Peoria, I remember as well. And I gave talks sponsored by the Ancient Order of Hibernians about the Irish famine. And after the talk, people came up to me in their 80s and said, now we know for the first time why our grandparents would never talk about Ireland.
Oh.
And then the penny dropped and I saw these people for the first time as refugees. They were, if you're a refugee or if you're a trauma victim, you're not going to want to relive that trauma every day. Life would be intolerable. So more likely than not, you're going to bury the memory. And the trouble is it's going to come back and bite you at some point, maybe not individually, but culturally, if it's done on a large scale. And the 1995 was a time of remembering that which had been forgotten or buried. And the people who came to America would have been the survivors, you see. And my Jewish friends talk a lot about survivor guilt and the Holocaust. If you survived and other people died, if you guarded your food supply, for instance, in the famine and watched your family members, maybe there would be cousins dying. You're not going to talk about that or think about that too much. But then along two generations later comes Tin Pan Alley with its manufactured visions of an artificial homeland, not just Irish, but indeed many homelands, a kind of an invented wholeness that maybe is a kind of an almost an invented childhood. And now you can buy into that. Because it's good stuff. So that's what that's why these Tin Pan Alley songs appeal to people who just didn't want to remember, or maybe who didn't know about the tough times. Because even if these were dreamy, romantic visions of a homeland that never existed, it was good stuff. You could tell your children that this was a great place, but you couldn't really tell your children that after the famine, could you?
No. Oh, isn't that interesting? And it is. We were in Killarney a couple of years ago, too, and we met this gentleman who, we were on a tour somewhere, I can't remember where, something around the Ring of Kerry, and he was so deeply affected by the famine. It was all he could talk about, and he was still tremendously sad, and it struck me what incredible sadness and horror really was associated with that. What you said makes perfect sense. It was terrible.
Well, it was awful. And if you go to places like, say, Skibbereen in County Cork at the head of the Bizen Peninsula, where 70% of the people died,
Ooh. And
you see a churchyard with a famine grave, there's 700 bodies in there piled in a big heap. Again, you can have easily images of the Holocaust there.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes the Irish famine is known, perhaps inaccurately, as the Irish Holocaust. But there is some similarity in the sense that they're the nameless dead. And then the people who survive aren't awfully anxious to talk about the reality of the reality of the survival process.
Mm-hmm.
But and then there's the workhouse there as well. So if you go there to this day, there's a kind of the imprint of the sadness of the time. But they're forgotten people, you know. And if you're looking for roots in Ireland, you may come up against a dead end around that time because there's no story that you can connect to them. That's why the songs are so important, I think, because the songs, they bear with them a kind of a trace cultural memory, and they even if the window's a bit fuzzy, you can see something in there.
We go next to you. Thanks very much for your call, Bridget. We go to Rich from Rhinelander. Hey, Rich.
Hey, good morning. I get a little emotional when I tell this story, but I hope you'll bear with me. Our family background is not Irish. It's Eastern European from the Baltic states, that is Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. During the time of the Soviet occupation, which ran for about three-quarters of a century, 70 years or so, a friend said to me, those are not even nations or countries, are they? Another friend, an Irish friend, said to me, no true Irishman would say that. You have to get to Ireland, you have to sit in a pub, and you have to listen to them singing out a nation once again. And I did that. And I understood that people who have suffered understand other people suffering. And when I was finishing up a very brief Fulbright teaching experience in 1993, I took a plane over to Vilnius, Lithuania, And I stood on a hill, and I looked across the city, which was now a free city. And I was thinking of the Irish, and I was thinking of the Irishman who had married into our family, Robert Slattery, may you rest in peace. And I think that's why people have such high regard for the Irish and for the Jews in our culture, because among the best people who have suffered, they understand and identify with the suffering and captivity of others.
Thank you, Rich, for your call. Mick?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And any time, as an Irish person, I travel a lot in Southeast Asia, do an awful lot of work in Vietnam.
Really?
With the Irish Embassy, it's really kind of a branch of Irish aid. And what they do is they help generate awareness of and also create financial assistance for the victims of Agent Orange. It's now in its third generation. It's not water soluble, you see, this defoliant, and it's not really readily biodegradable. So it's in the food chain, and you find an awful lot of children being born deformed to this day. And they're nearly, I think, 9 or 10, I think, particular physical deformities linked conclusively now to Agent Orange. Also to children with AIDS, the children of migrant workers in the garment and footwear industries, they're particularly exploited, women and children, different kinds of trafficking, mostly economic in Vietnam, and kids with any bloodborne disease like hepatitis, victims of unexploded ordnances. We do a lot of benefit concerts for people over there, and it's very nice to be able to introduce myself to Vietnam both as an American and an Irish citizen. I'm a dual citizen. One country, I wasn't here when the Vietnam War went on, but one country, you know, involved in an adversarial way, which I should say is completely forgotten now in Vietnam. Not forgotten, but forgiven. They're completely un-Irish in that. We forget nothing. We sing about it for 700 years.
Yeah, no.
The Vietnamese say, that was then, that was the American War, that's over now. And it's a young population who's interested in moving forward. But and also to be Irish, you know, coming from a colonised country, I find it really very interesting to be both, you know, to be part of a citizen of society that's never been colonised and also coming from a country that has been colonised. It gives you kind of a dual perspective. And people relate in Vietnam, I suppose, more readily coming from a colonised culture, you know, from the Irish culture, with the Irishness part of that. But they're very respectful of both, frankly.
Thank you so much, Rich, for your call. Hugh is next from Milwaukee. Hi, Hugh.
Hi. You were talking about early Irish visits to America. That was disputed, of course, but long before Columbus, there's the notion that St. Brendan sailed across the Atlantic to the New World. But more important, and I want to compliment you for this, because there are many people who have been on this network, and they say that John Kennedy was the first Irish president. But if you include the Protestant Irish, if you include the Scotch Irish, Jefferson, and many others, all the way up to McKinley, and of course Nixon, all of these were Protestant Irish background, and it's neglected. Unfortunately, there are some here who say that basically, if you're not Catholic, you're not Irish. I think that's unfortunate, and I compliment you for including the orange. The Scotch-Irish had enormous influence on the culture of the South. Also, what may not be well known, during the famine, many Irish came as ballast in ships to America. One of the big ports was New Orleans. Unfortunately, many couldn't stay because they were competing with slave labor, and they preferred to move to the north where they wouldn't have the competition how can you make a wage? How can you earn wages when somebody may have a slave?
Nick.
Yeah, one of my most moving moments ever in America was actually in New Orleans when there was a man who was a fellow called Rodney Jung, who was head of the Irish Cultural Society of New Orleans, and I was given a talk down there in Tulane University back in the early 80s. And he took me, he was the chief medical officer for New Orleans, and he took me to a grassy plain which was looked like a well-manicured golf fairway. And he said, we're standing here, he said, on what's called the Irish Channel. And underneath our feet are the bodies of perhaps 6,000 Irish people walled up in the walls who died in the yellow fever epidemic building the canals. It was the eeriest feeling knowing, again, here was another chapter in our history. And of course, all cultures have this history, that the unspoken or the buried history. That these, I had a feeling that, you know, I'll never know the names of these people. At that time, the Irish Cultural Society was involved in a battle with the city of New Orleans, who wanted to use that place for low-income housing. And they said, no, this is our ancestral burial grounds. And they were using the same rationale that Native Americans would have used, and a very good one too. And they kept losing at every stage of the court battle, but eventually went to the state Supreme Court of Louisiana, and they won. So now this is known as the Irish Channel, and there's no housing of any kind there, and it is a kind of a memorial to that. Again, mostly undocumented chapter in our history. New Orleans was a very important part of that.
Did you write a song about it?
No, because I'm not a songwriter. There's so many songs for me to learn. There are thousands and thousands and thousands of songs and thousands of tunes, and it's a particular talent to write new ones. I'm always up to my eyes trying to learn what's there already and arranging them and doing other kinds of things and teaching, and my friends Robbie O'Connell and Tommy Sands write all the good songs for me, and I'm delighted to sing them.
We'll take more phone calls in a moment. We have lines open. Thanks, Hugh, for your call. Irish Fest is celebrating its 30th anniversary. It starts tomorrow on the lakefront here in Milwaukee, and it is considered the world's largest Irish music festival, with people like Mick Maloney, who will be performing, and hundreds of other musicians. Northern Ireland is the cultural showcase. They have all kinds of other events going on, plays and lectures on poetry and dancing and theater and all of that. And there are dogs and there are Irish dancers, and it is a wonderful time. So we'll take more phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655 is our number here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
My name is Tim MacDonald. I'm a native of the Isle. I was born among old Aaron's bogs and left when but a child. My granddad fought in 98 for liberty so dear. He fell upon old Vinegar Hill as an Irish volunteer. So raise the harp of Aaron, boys, the flag we all revere. We'll fight and fall beneath his foes like Irish volunteers. So raise the harp of Aaron, boys, the flag we all revere. We'll fight and fall beneath its foes like Irish volunteers. When I was driven from my home by an oppressor's hand, I cut me sticks and greased me brogues and came o'er to this land. I found a home and many friends and some that I love dear. Be jabers, I'd stick to them like bricks, an Irish volunteer. Then fill your glasses up, me boys, and drink a hearty cheer to the land of our adoption and the Irish volunteers. Then fill your glasses up, me boys, and drink a hearty cheer to the land of our adoption and the Irish volunteers.
Mick Maloney and Irish Volunteers. You want to give us background to that song, Mick?
Yeah, that was written in 1861 in New York City by a man called Joe English, a very prolific songwriter. And of course, that was right at the most crucial time for America in the 19th century, the outbreak of the Civil War. And I was amazed when I found out when I came here how many songs there were about the Civil War and how many Irish-American songs there were about the Civil War. But then as I learned more about it, particularly from my late great friend Dennis Clark, who wrote 15 books on the Irish-American experience, I began to understand why there were so many songs, because it was kind of a watershed for us. Throughout the decade between the famine and the Civil War, we were very unwelcome immigrants. We were the first major flood of refugees from Europe, and we were white people, but we were Catholics. And we challenged America in ways that it wasn't ready for. A lot of discrimination against the Irish and an unwillingness really to incorporate them into things like American education. We were looking for our own schools and so on and building our own churches. A very tense time. Then along comes the Civil War and we enlist in huge numbers on the Union side, some indeed on the Confederate side, because Irish would have been there before, you know, the Scotch-Irish particularly in the South, the so-called Scotch-Irish. And they would have been on the Confederate side. But the vast majority of new arrivals were on the Union side. And we fought and died for the new republic. And there was great pride in that. We said, we're Americans now. Mm. And that's why the penny dropped. Again, there are all these songs celebrating that. And again, as Frank Hart says, or used to say, those in power write the history, those who suffer write the songs. Mm.
And we have a caller actually on the Irish Brigade, Tom, on the road near Wausau. Hi, Tom.
Good morning.
Hi.
I just wanted to mention to your guest, I don't know if he heard of the great tragedy that happened in Wisconsin with the Irish.
Tell me more about it.
In 1860... the time of the Civil War, which you were just talking about, we had a militia in the Third Ward of Milwaukee. And, in fact, my grandfather was great-grandfather. It was a great-great-grandfather. Okay, I'll get it right. was in that militia, kind of like a National Guard type of thing. There was many of them all through Wisconsin. But the governor, the Wisconsin, wanted to secede from the Union. And so he took all the guns away from the militia, and the Irish militia... in the Third Ward of Wisconsin there in Milwaukee, went to Chicago to listen to a Stephen Douglas debate and trying to raise money to get guns. And on the way back, the ship they were on, the Lady Elgin, was sideswiped by a lumber boat, and it sunk right off of Kenosha, Wisconsin. And anyway, there was about 700 lost a life. And those many of those adults, there was probably like 2,000 children that were orphaned and Irish descent in Milwaukee at that time.
Right. In fact, I'm very familiar with that story. And in fact, there's a song called The Wreck of the Lady Elgin, which is performed by Schooner Fair at Irish Fest several times. So again, we documented that in song as we documented just about everything. I was astonished when I came here and found that just about everything that we did here in America was documented in song, just like it was back in Ireland. Songs about the railroads, the canal building, songs about the Civil War, songs about the Irish and urban politics, coal mining in Pennsylvania, copper mining, Butte, Montana, the Gold Rush, you name it. If we were there, there was going to be at least one song about it.
Thanks so much for the call. What about the Irish participation in the Revolutionary War?
The Irish participation in the Revolutionary War would have been, I'd say, more from the northern side. In Pennsylvania, there was a line known as the Irish Line. And when the Washington won, when the war was over, it was viewed as back in Ulster as a victory for Ulster Presbyterianism. No great love among the Presbyterians for England at that time at all, even though their origins would have been Northern England and Lowland Scotland. And again, you think of General Jackson later on again as well. I mean, a fairly consistent anti-British and certainly anti-imperial feeling among the Ulster Scots or the Scotch-Irish, whichever would be the preferred term, and a sense of great pride in being American.
Hmm. Anita from Gurnee, Illinois. Hi, Anita.
Hi.
Hi.
I don't know where to start. Last year, we took a trip to the land of my ancestry, finally, to Ireland, and we saw a bit of Scotland. When we didn't do it on purpose, but we accidentally landed in Belfast on July 12th. I'm sure you'll get a kick out of that. What I couldn't get over was the fact how proud the people in Belfast were. They really were encouraging us to go see the parade. It is a grand thing and all of this. And given my Irish Catholic heritage, I was kind of taken aback. And then there was a guest on, I think it might have been your program last week, or else Jean's, I can't remember which, that was from the Northern Ireland, that he was presenting that point of view and saying that, I don't know why, you know, the Irish Republican people do not put aside the history. It's all history. It's all gone. And yet they have this parade every year to resurrect a bloody battle.
Mick.
Well, there's nothing intrinsically wrong with parades, and there's nothing wrong with remembering one's heroes. When parades are used as a kind of triumphalist metaphor from people who are oppressing a minority in the present, then a parade becomes a very, very tense occasion, and there's more likely than not going to be problems. One would like to think that we could look forward to a future where parades on both sides and symbols of identity on both sides would be proudly identified with and celebrated in a non-confrontational context. That's what we're all aiming for, and I think once you start banning things and burying things, you're headed down the wrong road. And there's nothing in the world wrong about going to an Orange Parade or a St. Patrick's Day Parade per se. It all depends what the context is. Mm-hmm. And as long as everybody feels that they're justly treated in the society, these parades, I'm sure, in the not-too-distant future will be just wonderful occasions where everybody can enjoy themselves.
I want to remind you, if you go to our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, we have two pairs of tickets for Irish Fest. We'll just do a random drawing. So just, you know, you need to sign up for it somehow. And we'll let you know. We're also there will be a picture of Mick on our Facebook page in moments.
Nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with that. About 45 seconds left. Your discussions about recognition of common suffering reminds me when Frederick Douglass traveled to Ireland, I don't know this story, emphasized the common experience of American slaves and the Irish. Certainly the history of persecution and scientific racism of the 19th century creates a bond between the African and Irish American population.
Absolutely, and our big hero, and his name is across all our monuments and big streets in our main towns in Ireland, Daniel O'Connell, he would have agreed totally, and he was the forerunner to Gandhi and to Martin Luther King in terms of his political attitudes to the use of force, and he never came to America because he wouldn't come to a country that had slavery.
I didn't know that.
Absolutely.
How could I miss that? Oh, I'm going to be reading about Daniel O'Connell now.
A mighty man.
A mighty man.
Yeah.
So are you. Thank you
well,
so
thank
much.
You.
Thank you so much for being with us. It was just a wonderful hour, and we look forward to seeing you perform.
Really enjoyed it. And looking over your head at the sun over the lake, what a lovely thing.
Yeah, I know. I know. Lots of lovely days ahead at Irish Fest. And it starts tomorrow at 5 o'clock. It is at the Henry Meyer Festival Park on Milwaukee's lakefront, a beautiful location. Come from anywhere in the state or beyond, and I can guarantee you, you will have a wonderful time. I always get sidetracked by just little stages where people are performing, and it's a lovely event. And I'm going to read about Daniel O'Connell. All right. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and thanks to Chrissy Pease for help putting music together and answering phone calls, and thanks for all of your calls, everybody. We have another hour coming up.